What's up, everyone? In this episode, I'm talking to Mike Alden, who's a former attorney. Now he's running multiple 7- and 8-figure businesses in the supplement space. So give it a listen. Hope you enjoy it. If you haven't given me a 5-star rating wherever you're getting your podcast, please do so. It helps me and it costs you nothing. Have a good one. Peace. And we're live. We got Mike Alden. Mike, thanks for taking the time, dude. I've been on Clubhouse listening to you and you just keep dropping bombs. And so I was like, I don't know if you know this. I used to be a lawyer too. So I saw your law stuff and I was like, we're a few good men that made it out, you know? So I felt like give a little background, couple minutes of, I want to hear from law school on of where you got to where you're at.
Hey, my story as a lawyer is just awesome. I always like to kind of start from the beginning, just in just to kind of give people perspective of kind of like who I am, where I came from, where I'm at now. And you know, I grew up, you know, surrounded by crime, drugs, violence. My mother is HIV positive. Stepfather died of AIDS. My father was addicted to coke. My stepmother just recently died. One of my brothers died of an overdose. Another brother was in jail for multiple years. Kid I grew up was in jail for life of murder. I wasn't really the best kid, you know, growing up. But there was a point in my life where I made a decision, right? You know, by the grace of God, go I, they say. And you know, your co-host Ryan's, I don't know, I'm guessing you might have played football, but if it wasn't for me, if it wasn't for sports, I wouldn't be where I am today. So you know, it's been a hell of a journey, but I wouldn't have really wanted it any other way. It was a really, really difficult way to grow up. But also, when you talk about, when people like to talk about adversity, like in the abstract, it couldn't have been more difficult for me. Now, I tell this story too because there are much worse situations than mine, right? You know what I mean? Like I used to fight all the time and things like that. And, but there wasn't, I was never really in fear for my life, you know, like some of these kids now that are growing up in Compton or south side of Chicago or some of these other areas that are just extremely difficult. But it was difficult. But again, I really wouldn't have wanted it any other way because it's really kind of, you know, made me the person who I am today.
Yeah. That's
where did you grow up?
So I grew up just north of Boston in a town called Beverly, Mass. So it's funny because Beverly Hills was founded from a guy from Beverly, Mass. And my ex-wife grew up in Florida. And she's like, you think you grew up tough? Let's go to like the, you know, some of the tough neighborhoods, like outside of Miami or Orlando, whatever. And so it's like, you know, if you came to Beverly, Mass, there's a, the coolest part about kind of my upbringing is this uber wealth, like the richest families, you know, in the world, like live here. It started here. Some of the, like, you know, the old money, started here. But then again, you got kids like me that grew up on, you know, on WIC and Section 8 housing and, you know, and in state cheese and things like that. So it was really kind of a cool diversity, you know, and mix, for me when I was younger.
That's amazing. And so you come from that. How did you end up in law school?
Yeah. Right. So growing up the way I did, I hated cops, man. I gotta be honest with you. My best friend's a cop, just so you know, but like, you know, like when you're younger, I don't know. I don't know if all elementary schools did this, but in second grade, you know, they put down like, you know, what do you want to be? And the kids are always like, I want to be a fireman. I want to be a police officer. I want to be a teacher. Second grade, I put down, I want to be a lawyer. I don't know that I even knew what a lawyer was. I was never really around lawyers, but something must have clicked with me, you know, at a very young age. And so I knew that I wanted to be a lawyer, one, because I had been around situations growing up the way I did where, quite frankly, there was just abuse of power. And, you know, cops walking into our house and without, you know, without warrants and, you know, and taking things and, you know, kind of wreaking havoc. And so I was just like, man, I want to learn what my rights really are. People talk about, oh, you know, they know their rights, but they really didn't. And I didn't either. So, you know, the reason why I start from how I grew up is because, like, you know, at 17 years old, my girlfriend's mother said, look, you're going to be dead by the time you're 18. And I'm like, fuck you, man. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm going to make something of myself, you know? And so graduate college, everybody graduates college now these days, right? Because it's a college for everybody. In fact, my guidance counselor told me that college wasn't for everybody. Actually, he kind of dissuaded me from going to college. So I also said, fuck you to him too. You know, graduated from college. I was like, all right, cool. But everybody graduates from college now, right? It's political science major, the only natural progression would be law school. So applied to law school, got bubbled like everywhere. I took the LSATs twice, got the same score twice, which is the test that you have to take before you get into law school. I was in the low 30 percentile. You know, yet again, the universe saying, hey, you don't deserve to be here. You know, I did anything and everything I could. You know, people talk about the grind and they talk about, you know, working hard I didn't know lawyers. I didn't know rich people. I didn't know any of that stuff, but I reached out to people that I did know that might have some sort of connection, even to some of the law schools here in Boston. And I ultimately got into Suffolk Law, and really kind of took advantage of it. And I loved every second of it, even though it was very stressful. I loved it though.
Did you practice after that? You practice law for?
Yeah, man. I tell you. So again, we were talking offline before this, like so I'll tell you a funny story, right? So first day in class, they go around. I went to Suffolk Law nights, right? Cause I worked, I was poor, I needed money. They go around the room and everybody introduces themselves. Now this is Boston, right? So Boston is the epicenter for academia, right? So you have Harvard here, you have BC, you have BU, MIT, you know, so some of the smartest people in the world come to Boston, right? So some of my classmates are from all those, Harvard, MIT. One of my closest friends went to Cornell, and everybody introduces themselves and they say, oh, you know, I'm already a paralegal, or I'm a PhD. I mean, there were doctors in my class. And so I introduced myself. I said, you know, my name is Mike Alden, and I sell cars at North Shore Lincoln Mercury. I went to Springfield College. If anybody needs a car, come see me. Right. The whole fucking room just died. They started laughing. Right. Everybody, like, I loosened up the whole room. That, by the way, I sold two cars as a result of that. A friend of mine who kind of grew up, this kid I didn't know, who kind of grew up the same way I did. He came up to me. He's like, Mike, that was unbelievable. Cause everybody was like, you know, hey, look, I'm a PhD and all this other stuff. And I'm like, I'm just this kid from Springfield College. The only reason why I got into Springfield was because of football. But I'm here. And someone yesterday, we met on Clubhouse. Someone yesterday was talking about, you know, imposter syndrome. Right. And I've always kind of felt that. I always felt like I don't belong or I shouldn't really be adding value. But the one thing that this guy said, and it really, this is why I love this app, Clubhouse, is he said, look, man, you're in the room. Right. So I was in the room. I was there. I made it in. You know what I mean? And so now it's like what you do with it from there. So I graduate law school. It's no joke. Literally the day I started at this company, I passed the bar exam, took the bar exam twice. First time I actually missed it by one question. What happens is it goes to a committee here in Mass, where it goes up to the committee and they review everything, right? Just to see. But I missed it. There's a whole, we could talk forever about why I missed it. I ultimately just didn't study enough. I mean, that's just the way, that's really what it came down to. Second time I crushed it. In fact, day two, I could have not even showed up day two and I think I would have passed, because like that's how, you know, solid I was.
Yeah.
So I passed the bar exam. I got a job at this company at a call center that I was working at. I was working at this call center that was selling supplements on television, right? I knew that they needed a lawyer because they were growing. I didn't know anything about really what was going on with them legally, but the day I started, they were sued by the FTC, the FDA, the IRS came behind them, and then it went criminal. Like literally, like I didn't even have my BBO number yet. So I when I was responding to pleadings, I don't know if anyone's ever experienced it. I don't know many people that had. I actually had to write BBO pending. I didn't even have a number. So that just highlighted for the FTC, like that this young lawyer who is no, and by the way, I had no idea. Now we had outside counsel. I mean, don't get me wrong. It wasn't just me, but that was my experience, my indoctrination into practicing law and to this industry and this business that I'm in right now, which is, you know, the direct response industry. And I tell you, it was an amazing, when I told some of my friends that went to Harvard, MIT, Cornell, what I was doing, I had to expedite my license in federal court, because, you know, you don't just automatically get licensed in federal, because this is all federal court, right?
Right.
And so that was kind of like my beginnings of the legal career. And what was awesome about it was I literally had to learn every aspect of the business that we were in, which ultimately, you know, kind of got me to where I'm at today, because my business that I started in 2008, which is essentially the same thing that they were doing, I just learned how not to run a business and I didn't do any of that stuff. And I took all the good stuff and started my company.
That's crazy. And a little bit of background. A lot of people that listen are lawyers, bankers. I talk to a lot of those people that went to Ivy League schools and are in big law firms and big investment banks and are trying to figure out how to get out. And I think they'll hear that and be like, I wish I went to Suffolk instead of freaking Harvard, because that sounds so much more.
Well, Suffolk too. Like my school is like, we're like, you know, blue collar guys and gals or whatever, you know, you go to law school nights and, you know, look, you go to Harvard, you know, a friend of mine's daughter just got into Duke and, you know, I think it's like top 10 and, you know, you pretty much can punch your ticket then when you graduate from a top 10 law school in any economy, you're going to get a six-figure job pretty much right out of the gate. And then it just becomes whether or not you know, you want to live that lifestyle. Like, you know, if you want to just literally sleep in the office for your first couple of years, then cool. Then that's great for you.
But yeah. Most of them don't. I mean, I went to University of Chicago. So all of my U Chicago, but I got three messages on LinkedIn today before I got on. It's like, hey dude, the grind is real. So how would you get started from an entrepreneurial standpoint?
Transition
like,
it out.
I can't do this for another 10 years.
Yeah, man. It's stupid. You know, see the thing too about like the law, the, I mean, I love the law and I loved, you know, educating myself and really, you know, working it and using it to your advantage. But at the same time, it's very emotional if you're, especially if it's litigation. Right. And so, I hated litigation and, because it's just emotional. I don't care what anybody says. And it's high stakes. I mean, the lawsuits that we were involved in, I mean, when the FTC sued the company that I was with, there was a $54 million lawsuit and it was effectively, I mean, the first thing they did was they moved for an asset freeze and a restraining order. That was the first thing. That was the first thing I saw, like any sort of legal pleadings. It was pretty much game over. Yeah. Like that was it. We had, and by the way, they moved ex parte, right? But it got converted to a short order of notice. So we did have 10 days to respond, but they originally moved ex parte. Like they were coming guns blazing to shut down my company. And you know, and it's very emotional. I mean, I remember sitting in the owner's office and I was like, fuck man. Like I just got this job. By the way, it was $65,000 a year to start. And they agreed to pay my car payment. I was driving a Mercury Sable. And I was like, I remember saying to myself, I'm like, I think I have a week and then that's it, you know, because if they had won, I probably wouldn't be talking to you right now.
So after a start like that in law, how long did you stick with it?
So it was amazing. So that was 2004 when that whole thing happened. And then so from 2004 to 2008, you know, I cleaned up their business pretty quickly. We conducted, you know, great business. We probably did like another, I don't know, $200-300 million in revenue and other campaigns, all while under this big, huge, giant lawsuit from the FTC. I mean, they were coming. There was essentially no defense. I mean, by the time I became their lawyer, it was just there was no defense, and it was ultimately it came down to unfair and deceptive trade practices and some of the claims that they were making about supplements. But if they had done it right, if they had had the proper substantiation, if they had just maybe made some literally minor tweaks in some of their advertising, their call center, some of their call center practices, if they had really kind of just really, really simple stuff, you know, again, I probably wouldn't even be here because they ultimately went out of business as a result of it. So from 2004 to 2008, that was my life. I started my company Blue Vase in 2008. And the worst economy in the history of the world up until this point, right? So I keep my license active. You know, they say, you know, never represent yourself. You know, what's the whole saying about a lawyer represents himself as a fool for a client? Yeah. So, you know, but yeah.
And so walk me through what Blue Vase does and how that transition happened.
Yeah, you know, so we, again, I looked at what, you know, supplements. I've always been interested in supplements. I've always been interested in health and wellness since I was a kid. I'm a big dude. Like the size I am now, I think probably I haven't weighed myself in a while. I'm probably like 240, maybe close to 250.
Means how big are you?
Well, he's 6'5", man. Well, you're 6'5". So you're 6'5". I'm guessing you got to be like 275.
I'm 265.
All right. Look at dude. By the way, if this thing doesn't work out for me, I could totally work at the carnival and guess people's weight. Right? I mean,
that's
was pretty
big money. Cool. That's cash business. You don't have to report
dude. Like, I'm
on
like,
that.
I'm really good at that.
You're off on my height, but that's okay.
I thought you said you were 6'5".
No, just under 6'4".
Oh,
well, I'm 5'9".
Well, listen, so weight's my thing. Okay.
From my vantage, he looks 6'5".
All right. Yeah. So. So what do they do? We're direct response marketers. You know, we primarily market dietary supplements, health and wellness products, books. You know, it's kind of like this is like our wheelhouse. We've been focused primarily on television, which is I wouldn't call it a dying medium, but it's just changing, right?
And break down what direct response, like for non-marketers, like what is direct response?
Sure. You know, we offer a product or a service, and we sell directly to a consumer. So, what that means is too, is we elicit a direct response to our advertising. So we advertise, we want you to respond immediately. It's, in a retail setting, it's similar to like when you go to the grocery store. Nobody goes to the grocery store to buy candy bars, but sometimes you end up walking out with a candy bar. And the reason why you walk out with a candy bar is because it's an impulse buy that's sitting right there. So that's essentially what we're doing. So there's a problem with a solution, and we want you to essentially directly buy from our advertising almost immediately.
Got it. You have a supplement that makes you taller? Ask him for a friend.
Taller?
He's asking for
yeah. We got that. Listen, anything you need, man. Anything you need to grow. Yeah, we got that for you.
Oh, that would be asking for me. So.
What? Yeah. So Bluvay started. So you started, I guess you mostly are building the advertising campaigns around other people's products or your own products as well?
It's mostly ours, you know? So it's funny, as a lawyer, you know, I didn't really focus a lot on intellectual property in law school. But then you start to realize the value of it. Right. And so a lot of times people will come to us with a product or an idea, and depends how far along they're at. We'll either just license it or we'll completely take it over and own it and then pay them a reverse royalty. The products and services that primarily that we're marketing right now and selling on television and obviously on the internet, we own. But if someone did come to us and say, hey, you know, this is what we're looking to do. Like I was just on the phone with Kevin Harrington, who's a good friend of mine. And, you know, a lot of times Kevin he'll refer me supplements cause that's our thing. And I'll refer him like, you know, gadgets and stuff. Cause that's his thing.
He'll refer it to you for you to, I guess, do the marketing for them and that'll be the part of your business that you're not actually pushing your own product.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, we'll create the advertisement, we'll do the creative, we'll build the websites, create any sort of additional IP that's needed with it. You know, we'll also do a lot of the legwork to the behind the scenes stuff that I've talked about before, like the non-sexy stuff of like, hey, you know, like I had this product years ago and it was a software that you'd put on your phone that created a mirror image of your phone. Now iPhones and Androids kind of already offer that as a free service. And we called it OmniSpy, right? And we're like, cool, this is like a cool name. And we were marketing it towards parents for their children, right?
Yeah.
Now, I mean, that stuff exists now too. And, you know, so we're getting it together. And, you know, I have a whole legal team, you know, that works for me. And I remember when one of my paralegals comes in the office and he says, Mike, what are we going to do? And we were calling it like a security app, security for your kids or security for you, right? And he walks into me, he goes, how are we going to deal with this security issue? I said, what do you mean? This is the essence of it. He goes, no. How are we going to deal with the guy that's promoting it? I said, what do you mean? He goes, dude, he's going to jail. I said, for what? He goes, he got convicted of securities fraud. And I'm like, he's going to jail. And I was like, what? And my point is that he didn't tell us that, right? So we're doing all the due diligence. So a lot of times we'll get a product, we'll get to the point where we're vetting it, and we're like, no, we can't. You know, we're not gonna move forward with it. So we'll do all that stuff, you know, kind of even for them as well, because a lot of times too, people will have a product like we're just on Clubhouse, right? And this girl goes, she's got this mask. Okay, I'm wearing the Gator one. She's got this mask, and she says she's got a patent on it. Right. And I said, in my head, I was like, wow, you have a patent on a mask. And I'm like, so you must have saw the future, right? Like, why would just an individual, some person who's hasn't really been an entrepreneur, all of a sudden have a patent? And I was like, is it a patent or is it patent pending? Because it's a big difference.
Yeah.
And she goes, oh, well, it's patent pending. Now this other guy chimes in and he's an IP lawyer. He was on he's in this room and he was like, whoa, 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 whoa. You know what I mean? So it's stuff like that, you know, when my point of all this stuff is when someone brings a product to us, we'll vet it. And sometimes too, we'll just make it better. Like if someone comes to us with a dietary supplement with a formula, like this girl, again, today was on Clubhouse talking about this fat loss formula, a cream that you put on your body. And I've seen the science on it and it's junk. And so I sent her a message. I'm like, do you have science on it? She's like, oh, I get the science. I'm like, no, you don't, but that's, you know, so yeah, we do literally everything from soup to nuts.
Of the products that you have insourced, whether they're your products or people that you've been pushing as the marketer, what are you think some of the key markers now that you've been in the business where it's just like this, I always learn more from the failures, because you can usually like put that to something of the ones that just haven't taken off like you thought that they would. Because at the beginning, every product seems like it's going to be the one.
Right.
What do you think are kind of the common narratives where you've seen and you're like, this, it didn't happen the way that we thought that we would, and here's why?
Yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting question, because everything I've done, we always put our best foot forward. We always think it's going to be the next best thing. And, you know, Kevin Harrington, when he was on Clubhouse yesterday, he was talking about his failures. And, you know, people don't realize this is, you know, I failed at like 90% of the things that I do. Yeah. I started a daily fantasy sports company. The reason why I started a daily fantasy sports company is a crazy story. Is Jason Robbins, the founder of DraftKings, and I both won the 40 Under 40 award in Boston for the Boston Business Journal. And I knew he was going to be there. So I'm like, I'm going to pitch this guy. I'm doing an infomercial. This is like 5-6 years ago. Right. So I go and pitch this guy, and quite frankly, he was just a dick to me.
Yeah.
So I was like, fuck this kid. I'm like, I go home and I start talking about it, you know, with my wife's cousin. And he's like, listen, man, this is what I do. He goes, I write about daily fantasy sports. I go, what's it called? He goes, it's called Draft Demons. I go, dude, let's start our own daily fantasy sports. I knew nothing about daily fantasy sports, but I saw the opportunity. I got smoked. Like I thought I was going to compete with DraftKings. Like, what are you like? I mean, it's insane. I wrapped a NASCAR multiple times, like not just like the actual Spring Cup series. You know, I did that a bunch. I launched a vodka that didn't work. I bought a company that's in the distilled spirits space in Ohio. That thing just totally flopped. They lost a shit ton of money on that. I've done probably, I don't know, 100 infomercials here in our career here, and only like 3 or 4 of them have worked. You know, so to answer your question is I don't think people really know. I mean, you know, there's all these different marketing gurus that'll tell you, you know, to do copy tests and, you know, or these, even like these web guys too. They're like, is it, you know, red or blue and blues, but all these different things, but right. You really don't really know until you release it. Right. And so that's when you can start to tweak, and maybe you get a good response. And maybe if you just maybe literally tweak the word or the offer, and that's where people start talking about funnels and all that other stuff. So I don't know that there's really one like universal answer, but it's one of the easiest things to look at is there a problem, and do you have the solution? I mean, it's the most basic thing in the world. And if you do, then from there, the thing that I tell people all the time is that you have to be able to tell a better story. Okay. So my products, again, dietary supplements, I mean, one of them is a glucosamine joint health product. You go to GNC, there's 50 glucosamine products. Right. You go to Rite Aid, Walmart, Walgreens, whatever, there's a million different, and the pricings are prices all over the place. And I built my entire life on selling glucosamine and vitamin D, ingredients that have been around since the beginning of time. Why? Because we're just able to tell a better story. You know, this hat that I'm wearing, it's for a product called Hempseen. And, you know, we're the only ones on TV, a long form advertisement explaining like, what is CBD? You know, tell me the differences between CBD and THC. What is like, people talk about cannabis, like, is like, what, you know, what does that mean? What's hemp? What's cannabis? What's marijuana? So we educate people, and then we tell them about the benefits of it. And we talk about the problems that they may have, and then the solutions that they may have. So what makes us better than everybody else is our ability to tell just a better story.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you, we're going to go down the supplement rabbit hole for a second, just because my wife is a fitness influencer. Her name is Fitness Carly. And so we've been looking at acquiring a supplement business or potentially starting one. And we've dabbled in supplements, and it's been okay. What do you think of, or have you seen at all, kind of this trend towards more body information, like glucose monitors? Have you seen like Levels and some of these businesses that are trying to get glucose and kind of attacking the glucose? And you said glucosamine, which I don't know what that is. I assume it's something to do with
it. No, they're totally opposite.
Oh, really?
Glucosamine, it's the opposite. Yeah, glucosamine is stuff for like for your joints and stuff like that.
Got it.
Know, so you're talking about things like, you know, looking at, you know, your sugar levels. You're talking about IGF-1. Right. You're talking about, you know, hormone levels. And I think you're also even starting to go down the route of maybe even customized vitamins, right? So a lot of people do that. They look at your blood levels. They look at your blood type. They look at your body type, you know, and then they say, well, these are the types of vitamins that you should take. I think it's interesting, you know, when people do that. But you know, and you know, this is that, you know, the reason why Gary V like releases all of his stuff for free, and he's talked about this before, is because he realizes and he knows that most people aren't going to do it. They're not going to implement it versus these other people who charge this stuff. It's the same thing. So if you tell somebody like, hey, you know, you have to do certain things in order to get this, they're not going to do those things. They want a pill. They want the magic potion. They want to take something. Right. And so that's just the society that we live in. And I think it's with the advent of social media and things like this, like, I think it's getting worse. You know, all this information is there, like on Clubhouse that we're, you know, what we met on, or YouTube or whatever, like all the information's there, like whatever it is you want. Most people just won't do it.
And they spend, now there's I haven't been on Clubhouse in a day or two, cause I'm just like, I need to execute on three things that I've learned from Clubhouse, and I'll circle back to it in 4 days. Like, I can't just like keep learning. Right. And there's like tons of like good tips and tricks and like new tools and email market. Like, you could spend your, like, you could just like spin your wheels. It's way too much information. Like, you just got to go execute on like one thing today, and before you go learn anything else.
Right. Absolutely. But yeah, just, I mean, if your wife's in fitness and she has a following, I think, you know, and when you think about supplements, or you think about food, right? It, you know, so there's one thing that I can guarantee will never change from the beginning of time to the end of humanity, is we're always going to need some sort of sustenance to keep us alive. And so, you know, at some point we might get to a point where you literally could take a pill and just not eat for a month. I don't know. I mean, who knows what that's going to look like? I mean, you know, you see, the evolution of drugs and kind of how they're working with, you know, with like literally nanobots that are like these little tiny like robots that people are just taking and swallowing, and they're looking in there. So it's changing, but I can probably pretty much guarantee that you're going to need to eat something. You're going to need to drink water. And so the cool part about that is that it's consumable and repeatable, right? So if you do have a product that's good, you know, like our product, our CBD line, you know, people want to take it, you know, over and over and over again, because once it works for them, not to say that they'll never get off it, but they're sticky. They're going to stay on for a while. Yep. Sticky. I like that.
Yeah, Means has been on that
sticky
stuff.
Sticky, icky.
Sticky. Cream of that lady that you said was going to burn the fat. I would have bought. I'm sold. Where can I get Means that?
I've tried that stuff, man. Like, again, I've tried every diet and taken every pill potion you can imagine. Like I said, when I was younger, I didn't even get into it. So people always thought I did steroids because I've just been a big dude. I mean, you know, when I went to college, I'm going to brag a little bit. I went to college, I benched 225, 31 times, you know, in the first year, right? And the coach, everyone's coming up to me saying, hey man, you got to get on the vitamins. I didn't know what the fuck these guys were talking about. Vitamins. Like the coaches were pushing this. We were D2 and then we dropped to D3. And I was like, guys, like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, and by the way, and I realized, like, again, we went 1 year we won like the D2 national championship. And it was just like, And then they tested everybody for steroids. They randomly tested everybody for steroids after. And the people that they tested were like not even remotely on steroids. It was so fucked up. And it was just like it was so gross. I was like, why are you testing us after? like you got to test before. So my point is like when I played college football, I hated every second of it because everybody was juicing. And we're fucking D2, D3. And I was already strong and fast naturally. I mean, I took every supplement you could imagine, but then when I saw like what's going on, I was like, man, it's like, it's a fucked up space. And now these, you know, now later on that people don't know, they get cancer, they get, you know, they're losing their hair. It's like, it's a nightmare.
I got a question that is, I want to know about your book writing and how you have time to crank out three books that are all bestsellers. I've gotten like 6,000 words into a book and I'm just like, I'm out. This is too hard.
Yeah. You know, so for me, like, I mean, it's funny, like we talked about like, you know, the imposter syndrome and then I talk about like who I was and who I am and who people still kind of like maybe even perceive who I am, you know? So there's that whole kind of like internal struggle of like, you know, I want to show the world that, hey man, I'm fucking great. And yeah. You know, everything that you thought about me was wrong. And so my first book is titled Ask More, Get More. Right. And how it even happened was I was going to do what a lot of these guys are doing now online, where I was going to create a publication and then I was going to do like a whole lead gen thing and bring them down a funnel, right, and then sell them this back end, you know, thing. Like I get like right here, like, does anybody know what these things are? You know, these are, so like, you know, we had like a whole, like I developed like this whole training
for
program.
Those on the podcast, he's showing some plastic cookie thing.
Oh yeah, that's right. For those of you who are listening. Yeah. It's this round disc that I don't know. There's like you might put it in like this insert.
Is that a cassette? Is that the cassette?
It's an 8-track, not really sure what it is. And so, you know, so I wrote that, and that was the plan. Right. And then as I started writing, I realized, well, man, like I actually kind of have a cool story. Like, you know, I have actually some information to share with people and I think it's valuable. So I just kept doing it. And then I'm like, and then I had like people within my office read it and then like edit it. Like my CIO is actually, his undergrad degree is actually in English. And so like he edited it for me. And then I had a couple other people and then I had feedback and they're like, yeah, this is actually pretty good. So I was like, maybe I can get a real publisher. So Grant Cardone, his first book, well, not his first book, but one of his books, Sell or Be Sold, I think is with Greenleaf, who was my first publisher. And I was like, if it's good enough for Grant, good enough for me. And then, you know, I wrote the book, I sent it to them, and they said yes. And then they came back to me and they said, we need you to rewrite it. And I was like, like, what? Like, are you kidding me? I spent all this time. And so it's more about, for me, it was like cathartic, that first one, right? It was like, you know, like this is a real book, man. The title is cool. It has changed people's lives. It continues to change people's lives. I didn't really know that it was going to take on that trajectory at the time. But at the same time, like I wrote about things that's almost like therapy. Like I started out telling you about my mom and my stepfather and all this other stuff. To me, it's still like therapy. Like it's like, you know, because I also want people to know that you're not the only one that's dealing with, right, all this crap. You know what I mean? And so you just start writing and you don't necessarily have to, unless you have a book deal where there is a time frame. If you start like this, like you don't have a time frame. Right. You just start writing, and like with Ask More, Get More, and even my other books, I mean, you know, like I'd be like, you know, sitting in my car, and I'm just be like, oh, I got the story. I'm gonna write it down in my notes. I mean, yeah. I've written all over the place, and so you just start. Once you get to like 50,000 words, that's like a 250 page book. Then you got something, and then from there. Now the world has changed so much where it's like, am I going to self-publish? Am I going to go to a publisher? Am I going to go to a hybrid publisher? Like, what am I going to do with this thing? Am I, you know, what's my purpose? Like, why am I writing it? And for me, it was actually, goes back to that whole imposter syndrome thing. I wanted people to know that I'm not just some guy on TV, because I'm the guy on TV selling the stuff, the supplements. Right. Like, I'm not just some guy on TV selling, you know, dick pills that are putting people on auto ship. You know what I mean? Like, I'm a 3-time Wall Street Journal, USA Today bestselling author. And that, by the way, I have trouble saying that, because it makes me feel weird. Like, I'm just bragging or whatever.
Self-promotional. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean? But also at the same time, it's like, hey, you and I probably wouldn't even be on this if you didn't know that about
me. Right. And the because I've talked to a couple of my lawyer buddies and people that are just starting out on the entrepreneurial path, what I've learned just being in Clubhouse, really Clubhouse solidified it for me, is you have to develop the skill of your narrative of what it is that you do and how you help people. There's another good book by Robert Greene called 48 Laws of Power, which is all about.
I wholeheartedly disagree with that book. I think that book is fucking evil. That book is fucking evil. I think, you know what? I'm hanging up right now. I'm telling you read it. Listen, let's be honest about that book. That book, you have to agree with me that it's evil.
In the wrong, if taken in the wrong light, I completely agree with you.
I mean, he blatantly tells people to like lie and cheat, like in the book, like, you know what I mean?
The part of it that I think is important, the part that helps me, is I'm normally like kind of do my own thing, not self-promotional at all. Right. And that's the lawyer in me, I think, you know, it's like, don't put yourself out there. You're setting yourself up for a lawsuit. Don't record anything. Right.
Right.
Like,
right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Down on paper.
Yeah.
And the, like the rule of like court attention at all costs and learning how to be malleable and be able to attract attention and to create relationships and move past your own personality limitations and do things that are uncomfortable to get
right.
goals that you otherwise want to pursue. I think that's an important switch. I think if you put it in Hitler's hands, you know, or someone who starts with a bad motive.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like
the
people that brought me that book, like this girl that used to work for me, she brought me the book, and she was just an evil person. I just knew she was. And I was like, and she was described. And I looked at it. I'm like, I tell people, like, if you like that, then get The Law of Success by Napoleon Hill. Like, get that book. Like, that is pure. Like, that is real. Like, there's nothing really in that book that's going to, like, give you, like, these, like, kind of nefarious thoughts. Like, that book, I think, I mean, like you said, you put 40 Laws of Power in front of a criminal, they're going to be a master criminal. You know, so I would suggest anybody who even has read that book or considering that, take a look at Napoleon Hill's The Law of Success, not Think and Grow Rich, The Law of Success. I think I have it. Well, I definitely have it here somewhere.
But I also think for those who read 48 Laws of Power and Robert Greene, it is important to be sensitive. And law school pounds this into your head. It's important to be sensitive that there are people out. You can't be just Bambi out in the woods and expect that everyone's coming to the table with good intentions. And
true.
And 48 Laws of Power at least gives you a dynamic and a framework to, for me, it helped me get outside myself a little bit more
right.
and be able to build a self narrative. But I also think it helped. I mean, my wife had the same, I gave it to her and she's like, this is evil. I think it's a fair response. But I also think that for my wife, who can't defend herself in this conversation, I think it's there are a lot of naive people who think that everyone comes to the table with good intentions.
Sure.
And it's and that can lead you down a bad road, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, again, as lawyers too, like we're trained also to be skeptics and also to kind of like see beyond just the words that are there too. So like, I think, you know, you can read it and, you know, it's like reading the Bible too. Right. I mean, if people took the Bible literally,
right.
you know, there would be, I mean, it would be okay to kill your brother. I mean, you know what I mean? So yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, just as a lawyer would say, it would be caveat emptor.
Yeah. But I do, there is a more positive, you know, think and grow rich. Those are everything in the positive light without really dwelling on the negative.
See, but the Law of Success isn't. So the Law of Success talks, I mean, Napoleon Hill talks about how he had partners who defrauded him and essentially had Napoleon Hill arrested and put in jail. And so, you know, so like he talks about all of like the negative things that can happen. And he talks about what your response you could be. Look, you know, you could read Machiavelli, The Prince as well. You know what I mean? Right. Like, you know, crush your enemies.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I love that. I love that book, you know, or you could read The Art of War, you know, right. and like, but I don't know. I think The Art of War is literally just outdated by about, I don't know, 1500 yeah, years.
Not
you know what I mean?
Practical.
You know, so take there's the all these ground, kind of like, yeah like my, yeah, take the high ground. And, you know what I mean? But like, you know, so there's a lot of great books out there. It just so happens that when you brought that one up, I obviously feel strongly
about that.
Which means, by the way, I have read it.
What are some things that you feel like on the subject of deprogramming yourself or reprogramming yourself? What are some things maybe for me, law school has been a big thing that I have to deprogram, where it's like lone wolf mentality of like you get school rankings and like everyone's against each other and everything's like zero sum games. That's been a big thing. That 48 Laws of Power is Robert Greene should sponsor this podcast.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's I was just making sure your name is Riley and it's not Robert. I just wanted to make sure, like, because I kept looking down. I'm like, that's Ryan, that's Riley. Okay, cool. Like, be awesome. That'd be awesome if I was just talking shit about your book to your face. By the way, I'm from Boston. You're like that. That's what we do. Like,
that's
I do
a
it
total
all the time.
Boston play. Yeah,
I'd be like, sure. Dude, you're a fucking idiot. Like, right to your, you know what I mean? It's funny, like the whole zero sum game thing, you know, which means that they're, you know, it's like either a winner or a loser, right? You know, I mean, that's where that book, you know, does kind of like educate people about, yeah, the real world is tough, man. Law school's tough. Like, sales is cutthroat. I sold cars right out of college and it was the best thing I could have done. But I also was like, I don't want to be a car salesman. That's a it's like the bottom of the barrel. It doesn't get any worse as far as like a perception of like who you are as a person, you know, but the skills that you can learn are just remarkable. And the skills that you learn as a lawyer or even as a law student, right? You know, when I went to law school and graduated law school and, you know, we're kind of, you know, patting ourselves on the back, but you know, you're in the top 1% of the world as far as academia, plain and simple. Right? And so, you know, the way we're taught as lawyers, I think one of the things that I have always used as a business person is, you know, as lawyers, we're kind of taught like worst case scenario, right? So like, if this, then that. It's like chess. It's like a big game of chess. And so you're always trying to think of like, what are my next moves? What are my next steps? Like if I do this, then I do that. Like, what are the legal implications? You know, what are the financial implications? And so that's what I loved about law school and the way we're trained, where a lot of people don't get that type of training. And so, yeah, I mean, I think in any business transaction or any personal transaction, I think zero sum, is a rare instance where it needs to be that way. I think that, you know, if you can, you know, it's cliche-ish, but if you can go in with a win-win, then the other person is going to be happy. You're going to be happy. Could you have got a little bit more? Could you have taken the person out completely? Sure. But will you be able to sleep at night? I don't know. I wouldn't be able to. Like Donald Trump, I mean, he's a zero. I mean, like, he's a Machiavellian, you know, so like he'll obviously he's doing it now with the country, right?
Right.
Doesn't give a fuck, and he's gonna win, period, or he's gonna try to win, period, at all costs. And you know, we're seeing now that like being played live on the world stage and what that can do for humanity, and it's not good.
I figured, you know, you guys both went to law school, that they probably like had lots of courses teaching you how to sleep at night, that'd be something that was like a struggle for you guys.
No, they teach you, listen, you when you graduate law school, when you pass the bar, you now have a license to steal.
Yeah.
That's litigation, yeah, you know, like, and it's funny too, like, you know, same thing, like I can't stand most lawyers. Like most lawyers are complete fucking assholes because of what I just said. You're in the top 1%. I was on a phone call with this guy. This is great. It was a huge company that's in my space, that's also on TV, that is still on TV, and they're three letters, so I'm not gonna say who it is, but you right. So I'm on the phone with this guy, and the guy goes, he tells me that he went to Harvard undergrad and he went to Harvard law school. He knew, because I'm in Beverly, Mass. So he knew. And I was like, oh, cool. And I was like, so you graduated law school? He said, of course I did. You know. And by the way, this is like pre-litigation. Like we're getting ready to go to war, right? And no one told me anything about this guy's background. And again, I went to Springfield College and Suffolk Knights. And, but I'm general counsel of this company. We're doing, you know, so like, you know, I feel pretty good. And, he says, yeah, I went to Harvard undergrad and I went to Harvard law school. And I said, did you, he was in California though. I said, did you take the bar here in Mass? He said, yeah. I said, did you take it in California? He said, yeah. I said, did you pass in both states? He said, yeah. I said, that's interesting. He said, why? I said, because I also took the bar exam and I also passed. And I said, you know what that means? And he was like, we're both fucking lawyers. That's what I said to him, just like that, you know? So now, and then I also went on to tell him, I said, you know, here's something to you. So they were threatening to sue us. And he was just telling me how big and great and strong he was, whatever. And I said, you need to understand something. This is one of the things that I'll tell people. I talk about this in my book, and it's a great way. It's a crazy way, I think, to conduct yourself in business, but it's also a great way. I told him, I said, listen, I just want you to know that we're not afraid to lose. And he said, what? He said, they were suing us for like $5 million, something like that. I said, just so you know, like we feel really good about where we're standing as far as our case. And I'm sure you do as well. I go, but I'm just letting you know, and because you should, you know, you're obligated to let your client know we're not afraid to lose. And he said, well, that's an enviable position to be in. But my client does, you know, we want to win. And I said, okay, well, I'm just letting you know. And I've taken that, philosophy in my life. And it works great, because if you're not afraid to lose, if you're comfortable, if you can truly get comfortable with the worst case scenario, then everything else from there, you really put yourself in a position of strength. See, I've really never been in a position of strength. My companies have literally generated hundreds of millions, but I'll tell you this today, like I'm not sitting on a pile of cash. I'm just not, you know what I mean? Everything I've ever made, I'm always putting it back into the business, and I'm putting myself at risk like all the time.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm willing to lose. I don't want to lose. but I'm willing to lose because I'm trying to get to another level. And so a lot of people get really uncomfortable with that. They're afraid to lose. I wrote an article for a magazine here in Boston called Boston Magazine. And the title of it is I'm a Great Loser. My mom's like, Mike, why are you doing that? Why are you calling yourself a loser? It's just because I'm good at it. I mean, what do you mean you're good at it? Well, I can lose and I can deal with it. Most people can't. So as lawyers, again, we're taught worst case scenario. If this happens, then what? Like, what are you going to do? If you go out of business, what do you get? In 2016, I built this fucking massive house in a private neighborhood in the town that I grew up in. Again, big giant exclamation point on, hey, I'm not this kid from the projects anymore, right? Yeah. I come into the neighborhood, I'm bumping Ice Cube. My neighbor's a doctor. This other guy's I'm a fish out of water. But in 2016, I built it in 15, 2016, I got hurt really bad. I put my house back on, I had put it on the market. And it was embarrassing. And I laid people off and I cut salaries and I did all these things. And I put myself in jeopardy of getting sued from some companies. But those are the decisions that I had to make. And at the same time, I didn't like it. I wasn't really 100% comfortable with being uncomfortable, but I made those decisions knowing that I had to make those decisions. And ultimately, if the hammer did drop the way it was looking, then I was like, all right, I have to be prepared for that, because what else are you going to do? Like, right. Are you just going to like curl up in a ball and call it a day? And by the way, like, yeah, I wanted to do that a lot. And, you know, I think a lot of us as entrepreneurs still want to do that, but you know, it's a mentality that you have to learn over time.
And it's so key. I talk a lot about the difference, and Ryan and I are in a business together in the family entertainment business, which got crushed by coronavirus. And in 2020, we played it. I think we played it wrong because we initially took a very defensive posture, right? It's the difference between taking a defensive posture of how can we conserve cash and play defense and try to ride out the storm versus an offensive position of how can we go out and acquire and grow big and put the foot on the gas. In 2021, my own personal mantra is like offense, optimistic offense, because I'm naturally pessimistic as a lawyer and also defensive postured as right. a lawyer. And so like doing that is that position of discomfort. And most people live their whole lives in defense. They try to save their way to wealth, right? They try to coupon clip and they try to save $6 at the store instead of going out and making more, playing offense, starting businesses, right? I listened to your thing on pivoting, which is another great, great one, right? A lot of people don't have the stones to keep money on the table and pivot and keep parlaying into a whole new business line. And I think over time it plays out. I know you just interviewed Grant Cardone, and I think Grant's whole message is offense, not defense, right? Make more, don't save more. And as long as you're not sitting on piles of cash, which is a defensive position, right? You're going to go out and you're going to increase and play offense, which is ultimately the guys who win in a big way are offense guys.
Yeah. And, you know, and you also put yourself in a vulnerable position. Like every time, you know, and
it keeps you motivated.
It keeps you motivated. It's like, you know, when Grant talked about his, you know, program, the show that's coming out tonight at 6 p.m. on the Discovery Channel.
Yeah, check out the Discovery Channel.
Actually, by the time you hear this, by the time you hear this, it might be too late. But, you know, he talks about how success makes people soft, you know, and, you know, look, I've been through hell and back and more times than I like to talk about. But I think that, you know, when I had Les Brown on my podcast and Les is, you know, Michael, he says to me, it's the struggle that creates life. And, you know, and it's like, okay, cool. That's good to hear. And it makes you feel a little bit better that everybody's going through it. I have a friend of mine who's in his 60s. And I was like, man, fuck, dude, the struggle. It's like, so hard. I mean, just recently I was having this conversation with him. He's like, Mike, I've been struggling for 40 years. He's like, just get used to it, you know? And so, you know, it's never going to be easy. There's always going to be a different challenge, no matter what level you're playing at. But as long as you can understand that you're not always going to win, and the losses sometimes can be just gut-wrenching and physically and emotionally and psychologically detrimental to everything. And that's the life of an entrepreneur, and it hurts. And as a lawyer, you know, who is taught to be kind of conservative, see, I'm a little bit different because I was, you know, just, I'm just a different type of person. But at the same time, I have that mix of like, you know, understanding like the consequences, but also have that entrepreneurial spirit. So that's why I think that I've been able to get to where I'm at today, because I'm willing to take those chances. And, you know, and I've lost big, man. Like the daily fantasy sports thing was fucking huge. I lost a ton of money on that. The vodka that we launched, I lost a ton of money on that. I'm looking at one of our point of purchase displays. It's absolutely beautiful. I backed an artist, insane deal. I got him into Art Basel. Like I lost on that deal big. But I believe the other thing too is I believed in it, right? A lot of people talk about, oh, I had that. Like in my first book, Ask More, Get More, I talk about this. I talk about this this product called Zeus Juice. It's a frozen shot with booze in it, froze solid. It looks like flavor ice with booze in it. I was the first person in the United States to actually get that type of packaging approved by the ATF. At the time, it was called the ATF, right? And so now it's called TTAB, tax something, dumb something, something. But it's not the ATF anymore. But anyway, so I get this thing approved, and we were in college, Springfield, we're doing shots and we were chasing it with flavor ice. I came home and I was like, man, it'd be kind of cool if I could put this in, you know, in the same package and sell it. And people says, oh, alcohol doesn't freeze and blah, blah. I know nothing about distilled spirits. I know nothing about chemistry, but I was like, this is a cool idea, right? And I had no money. I had no contacts. I didn't understand the industry. I'd never been in the industry, but I was like, you know what, man, I'm young enough that I can withstand the loss. I launched the product and we were on the cover of Stuff magazine. If everyone remembers what a magazine is, and Pamela Anderson was on the cover and the article that they wrote, and the headline was it, hey kids, you should try this. Oops, not for you. And I'm like, as a lawyer, I'm like, you fucking kidding me? And I was in law school when that happened, but the sales went through the roof. We were crushing it. I ultimately went bankrupt because of like actual bankruptcy, right? I had to file bankruptcy because just, you know, I had to make a decision, law school or that business. And I went law school. So like a lot of people have ideas. And then my point with that story is that I've had people come up to me after the fact or when I was doing, say, oh man, I thought of that. Like I did that. I used to take orange juice and ice cubes and put vodka in them and put a little toothpick in it, and I would put it in the freezer. That's what I did. I was going to do that. I go, well, you didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean? We carry one of those products at our Texas location.
What's that?
We legit carry some frozen.
Yeah. So now, right. So by the way, I relaunched it in 2016, and then we got picked up by Glaciers, which is actually out of Texas, third largest distributor in the world. And we're, in the United States, and we're in 30 states and we're crushing it again. I'm doing the whole thing over again, but ultimately it just didn't work.
Right.
It just didn't make money, man. And it hurt because now I see these other ones out there, but I just know the model now that it just doesn't work. So I keep saying my point. Listen, if you have an idea, if you're thinking about doing something, I don't care what age you're at, you have to assess, like, do I have a family? Do I have a mortgage? Do I have all this other stuff? You know, try and take that idea and move it forward. And when I launched that product, Zeus Juice, like the internet was there, but it was like dial-up. I had dial-up. I had to sit there and wait like for an image to come up on the screen to like see if I was, what I was searching for was correct. I mean, that's what I was dealing with. But now, man, like anything you want to do, like, you know, you're going to hear Gary Vee and everybody talk about it. It's right here on your phone for those that are watching. It's there. And so it's a wild world that we're living in. So if you have an idea, don't be afraid to push it out, and don't be afraid to lose, because it most likely is not going to work.
Yeah, that's right.
Hey, I have a question for you. You mentioned that you're, you know, reinvesting everything you have. You're not sitting on piles of cash. You're playing offense.
Yep.
Because you want this next phase, or you want to get to this next level, you said.
Yep.
Do you have a vision of what that next level is, or like, do you know what your end goal is, or is it just some, I don't know, idea?
More.
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting question, right? You know, people have a number, right? And say, oh, I got, like, I have friends, they have a number, and then that's it.
I don't have a number. That's why I'm asking you. Like,
I don't either. So I don't either. So that's the thing, is it's like, my mom said to me, Mike, when's it going to be enough? Right? Like my house. Okay. Like most people, is you know, Grant would not call it an asset, but you know, I put a bunch down and it's, you know, over the few years, it's, you know, it's, the equity is gone. And so that's where almost all of my money is. Yeah. Right. And then everything else has been put back into the business. And so for me, I'll just be candid with you guys. Like, it's been 12 years and it's been fucking like brutal. Like I tell stories, like, I, you know, Years ago, before I got divorced, I was the, you know, sleeping in my basement with my dog, which I loved my dog, and she's gone now, but, and she's big, and I'm in my basement. It's cold, it's damp or whatever. And I would wake up every morning at 4:30 in the morning to check my phone, because that's when I would, that's when deposits would come. I had a bank account in California, and they would be deposited here in Boston. And so that's when we would see it. And one morning I woke up, and it was a payroll week. I had 200 employees, and it was negative $143,000. And I did not have the money. Like I couldn't sell anything. I didn't have credit cards. I didn't have credit line. I did not have. And so it, you know, I figured it out. We got it done. And I basically borrowed more money from this guy that I was borrowing money from, which ultimately, by the way, he said no to me like 10 times. And it all happened in one day. Like it was literally one moment, you know? And so I've had like catastrophic events like that happen to me over and over and over again. I told the story on Clubhouse where I had my merchant accounts frozen. I had $800,000 grabbed in one day. Then I was put on a list called the match list, which is like being a level 3 sex offender, trying to get a job at a daycare. It's the worst thing that could happen to anybody who processes credit cards. I'm a lawyer. I have dogs. I have an ex-wife. I have a wife. I have a mortgage. I have car payments. Like, I'm as real as it gets. I'm not some kid banging fucking credit cards in Costa Rica like a lot of these guys are doing, like these affiliate guys or whatever. Like, I'm a real guy, and I'm running a real business, but I just happen to get caught up in it because I sell supplements and, you know, whatever. So like and it's exhausting, man. It hurts. Like, nobody like talks about this stuff. Like, yeah. My book, Blueprint to Business, like I talk about this stuff, and I've been hurt over and over and over again. And it gets to a point. And I talked about pivoting in my recent thing where you have to say to yourself, like, what am I doing? Like, why am I doing this? Like, for me, you know, I have a brand called Wicked Happy, right? It's a clothing line. And it came about because of one thing that I just said. I was talking to somebody at my business. I was just tired. I was speaking at an event called Build Your Empire in Arizona. And I just said to my wife, I just said, you know, babe, I just want to be wicked happy. And it was all, there were all these t-shirt guys there. She goes, I think that's a t-shirt. And lo and behold, we have a whole clothing line. Like, that makes me happy. Like, that brand makes me happy. Some of the other things that I'm doing, this right now we're doing, like, we're not making money, but this makes me happy. And I've always talked about happiness. And now it's the in thing. Everybody's talking about mental health now.
Yeah.
Like, 2014 in my book, I told a story about how I had a fucking massive panic attack. I found transcendental meditation and it changed my life. Now it's the in thing because everybody's now actually realizing, holy shit, like mental wellness is a real thing and mental health is a real thing. Now, you know, insurance companies are not charging you anymore and you can do virtual therapy and all this other stuff. So like, I don't know that I'll tell you this. The one thing that I definitely want is, you know, when Cardone talks about success and, you know, makes you soft. But for me, like I'm trying to get to a point where the basics of like paying your mortgage is not a stressor. That's still a stressor for me.
Yeah.
My companies have generated literally hundreds of millions. It's verified. I've been in Inc. magazine, Forbes, the whole thing, like all that's real. That's all like you know, it's easily verifiable. I show you my tax returns, but it's stressful too, man. So I had a mentor say to me, he said, Mike, listen, 1 year we did, it was $37 million in revenue. I actually owed him $750,000. That's why he came out. I didn't even know the guy, by the way. His name's Charles Parisi. He's from New York, but he's by way of San Diego. I never even knew he even existed. I owed this other guy 750. He shows up out of nowhere. I bust his balls about it all the time. I go, Charles Parisi from Brooklyn, fucking look like a gangster. You own restaurants, the whole thing. Kind of weird, Charles. You just show up in my office in Boston. So he says to me, Mike, and he went over my financials, by the way, I paid him back. And he said, congratulations. You just generated $37 million this year. He's like, I just want you to know that, you know, there aren't many businesses that have ever done that and that will ever do that from now until the end of time. It's just awesome. Congratulations. He's like, but what if I told you, you lost $5 million? And I said, well, yeah, I think I know that. And he says, okay, well, what if I showed you that if you did $15 million instead of the $37 million and you were able to keep $2 million, which one would you choose? And you guys probably know my response. I said, I'd probably still do the 37, you know? And so I'm at a point now where it's like my revenue, to be honest with you, has just dipped and dipped and dipped and dipped because I got hurt really bad in 16. And you know, we're kind of coming out of it now. We're pivoting, but it's like, you know what? I don't know that I need this big company anymore.
Right.
I don't know that I need to be, you know, doing $100 million a year for me. And this, I really want people to listen to it. And it's hard because when you climb to the levels that I've climbed to and also fallen to the levels that I've fallen to, you do, your perspective changes and you're like happiness is a real thing, man. It's like, I'm not saying it. I'm saying it like from a real person. Like I have a painting by the way, this is an absurd statement I'm about to say, but I say it all the time anyway. I have a painting. It's an original painting from the artist Romero Brito, who, if you Google him, he's probably one of the most prolific artists of our time. Of the word happy over my fireplace in my house, in my bedroom. Okay. You have a fireplace right behind you. It's awesome, by the way. But like for me to even say that from a kid that grew up in the projects who was struggling to get and have milk for cereal in the morning, it's such an absurd thing. But the reason why I bought that painting, because it's the first thing other than my wife and dogs, it's the first thing that I see to remind myself, like, man, you know, happiness is something you need to work towards. And people don't understand that. We're not inherently as genetically designed to be happy. People don't understand that. Like we're it's the opposite. We're actually right, because we're designed to survive. We're right. Designed to be nervous and look and not get killed and or kill. We're not actually designed to be happy. So you have to actually work on it. When people understand that, they just get and Google it. I mean, it's the science is real. Like, so you have to work at happiness. And so for me, I'm like, man, it's a struggle every day. But that for me is like when Ryan, like, when you ask your question, I don't know that I have the answer other than the fact that I truly, honestly want to be happy. And it's hard because, like, if that means I had to sell my house or whatever, or if that means I had to downsize even more or get rid of some stuff or whatever, then, you know, then that's what you have to do. And I've made those decisions. I've made the tough decisions because, you know, Riley, you were talking about this earlier, is like, make those decisions now on your own before someone else makes them for you.
Yeah. So. Yeah, finding happiness on your own, and that's huge. And I think being in the jungle that is entrepreneurship, you think that money will be the biggest driver towards happiness, and you spend all this time trying to pursue it. And the few or the many that get it, once they get it, they realize that there's a whole different part of the game that they still haven't figured out, which is how to be happy, right? Which is a whole, and then there's a whole group of those people that never figure it out. I think.
Yeah. I mean, their most recent famous one is the CEO of Zappos, right? I mean, the guy who espouses, I mean, he has a book that's like titled something about something happiness.
And
right?
Everybody said how like gregarious he was, and he's such a community builder, and he's like addicted to the, whatever that nitrous oxide, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, he was not happy.
Yeah.
He just wasn't, you know right. What I mean? And I don't know anything about him, but you know, I saw, you know, stuff on the news like before that tragic event happened. But like, you know, so I think, you know, I think when, for me, it's like, you know, it's about just getting to that point where you truly are happy. And you know what? And I've had moments like where you're like, the other thing too, I had a friend of mine that actually committed suicide a couple of years ago. It was a very close friend. And he just obviously was not happy. And we were talking and he's older than me. And he said to me, Mike, you're going to be okay. I said, what do you mean? He's like, you're going to be okay. Like, you'll be all right, man. Like, you just have to understand that you will be okay. And so whatever it is people are going through right now, especially now, it's fucking brutal what's going on in the world. Yeah. Right. And I feel it too. I tell my family members who are struggling and, you know, I help out a lot too, but I'm like, you know, look, I'm no different than you. I'm just maybe playing in maybe a little bit bigger, you know, field or just a bigger pond or whatever. That's it. I mean, I still have bills and I still have all this other stuff. And, you know, so I think that people just, you know, if people can recognize that happiness is truly the key, then, and rather than success, right? Because people are like, oh, I want to be successful. Well, you know, what is your definition of success? Is it money? You know, Dean Graziosi is a good friend of mine too. He talks about, you know, look, you know, if anybody who tells you that, you know, that money doesn't buy happiness, it's kind of not true because it makes it easier. Right. Like money makes happiness easier, but you can still be happy without money. I mean, my father is a classic example. He's in the 70s. He just fucking chill, man. He's just like, whatever. And I'm like, he smokes a lot of pot too, but I mean, you know.
Maybe those are correlated. Yeah. And you could be super unhappy with money. And that's huge. I think that's a good, I know you're tight on time. So I appreciate the time, Mike. And I think it's a super important conversation for entrepreneurs and also people that have been highly educated. I think trying to figure out a way to to be happy and find a way in entrepreneurship. I think it's a super amazing story that you got, and the hustle that you've had, and the ups and the downs. I mean, it's crazy, but it's good entertainment at the very least. So
it's definitely entertaining.
So if you like the podcast, we'll link to Mike's podcast and Instagram and all that stuff. So hit him up. Until the next time, man, we appreciate the time.
Hey, I appreciate you. This is fun, man. Again, I didn't know you were a lawyer when we came on. I probably would have said no, it's all right. No, but listen, you've been great. Ryan's been great, and I appreciate you, man. Let's definitely stay connected, and have a wicked happy day.
All right, man.